Nicole, did you ever notice how the sign by Ace of Base has really strange key changes?
I did not, Mark. I'm a real person.
Well, let me tell you about it. I'll let you talk about neuroscience gobbledygook.
Yes, I thought you'd never ask.
This is the Nevermind the Music podcast,
where one psychologist
and one musician
deep dive into the songs you love.
So you don't have to.
And there's plenty of time to get off topic.
From Semi-Charmed Life to The Way You Move.
And who could forget The Crossroads?
Is it The Crossroads or The Crossroads?
Save it for the episode, Mark.
Listen to Nevermind the Music
wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Dr. Mike. We are taking a week off this week, but to keep the conversation going, we thought we'd share an episode from the vault with
Mackenzie Ziegler, otherwise known as Kenzie.
We'll see you next week with a brand new episode.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. Today we are talking with singer-songwriter Mackenzie Ziegler, otherwise known as Kenzie. You may know Kenzie from her singles Anatomy and Breathe, as well as her collaborations with artists such as Johnny Orlando on the song What If. Kenzie has a new album coming out on July 26th called Biting My Tongue that features the single Bad For You. Check out Kenzie's music and videos at HollywoodRecords.com. Today we are talking with singer-songwriter Mackenzie Ziegler, otherwise known as Kenzie. You may know Kenzie from her singles Anatomy and Breathe, as well as collaborations with artists such as Johnny Orlando on the song What If. Now, on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And perhaps one of the most difficult issues that we face on our mental health journey is how do we understand and develop close relationships in our lives? And how do we cope when the people who are closest to us let us down in a profound way, even to the point where we may have to end or severely limit a close relationship? Throughout our lives, we need relationships for so many things, especially when we are younger. This includes basic needs such as protection, food, and shelter. We also need people to validate and help us understand our thoughts and feelings. And we often need relationships to help us thrive, to have fun, to achieve a common purpose, to help us when we struggle. And so when relationships are going well and we are getting what we need, we can feel amazing. We feel more centered, at peace, whole, and fulfilled. We know there are people who have our back during tough challenges and celebrate good times with us. But when our relationships are not going well, when they're unfulfilling and even toxic, we can feel lonely, isolated, and afraid. This can be particularly the case when a relationship that we felt was previously going well, or we expected to continue to go well, suddenly turns. When we have let someone into our lives and allowed them to become an important part of who we are, and something changes. They let us down, they drift from us, or we realize that they were actually harmful in some way. And this can be incredibly damaging to our mental health and well-being. And Kenzie and I talked about how she has coped with difficult relationships in her life, including within her family, and how that has impacted her mental health journey. For her, this included learning how to set boundaries while still keeping an open heart and mind, that if someone were to change, she may be willing to let them back into her life. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so they can go there with us. So let's go there and listen to what Kenzie has to say.
Hey, Kenzie, welcome to Going There.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start with one of your songs that you feel best represents your mental health journey.
I think for me, I think it would be Anatomy at the moment. When I was younger, I dealt with a lot of struggle with not having my father around. And as I turned 18, I really faced it in therapy, which therapy was always a very scary concept for me. But as I continued to talk about it, I decided to write a song about it, which really helped me get over that fear of abandonment and people leaving me. And it had a lot to do with my anxiety as well. It definitely helped me overcome that. And I've changed a lot. I feel very proud of myself for talking about it.
Do you feel comfortable just talking about the circumstances, like what the relationship is or was not and how it affected you and, you know, how that changed through therapy?
Yeah, so my parents got divorced when I was around 4 years old, and he never really was around in my life up until that point. And then around when I was 18, I guess around when I was 17, I tried to rebuild a relationship with him just because he is my dad and I still loved him very deeply, even though he wasn't really present. And it didn't go very well. It is hard when, you know, I'm living in California and he's living in Pittsburgh. And so I tried to make it work and he just really wasn't present. So I wanted to write this song about it, which originally I wrote the song because my therapist wanted me to write a letter to my dad and basically burn it, which was kind of some sort of method that she thought of. And I didn't want to do that. I just felt like it would be really hard for me to put it into words. But then I ended up writing a song about it. And I sent it to her as my letter. And then I ended up releasing it. And I got amazing feedback from it, which really helped me get over it and kind of face it, because I had a lot of great reactions of people kind of sharing their stories as well. And it made me feel less alone. But talking about it in therapy was very hard for me, just because I never really talked about it. I would always make jokes about it.
Yeah, I have to say, "Hate That You're Half of Me," that's one of the best lyrics I've heard in a long time. I feel badly saying that because I imagine it came from a lot of pain.
No worries. Thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah, that concept when we're dealing with family, but particularly parents, is very tough because there's this sense of, how do I make sense of the fact that if they're biological parents or even if they're adoptive parents, that somehow they've been formative to who I am. And I have all these feelings, but those feelings are somehow outside of me, but they're also within me to some degree. And that becomes very complicated.
Right. Totally. I felt guilty for not loving him as much as my mom, because, you know, I've been around my mom my whole life and I really haven't been around him. So I think that's why I was trying to rebuild a relationship, because, you know, he is my dad at the end of the day. Can't really change that. But I also think that, you know, if someone's not there for me, it's not worth it in the end.
The guilt you're talking about, unfortunately, is incredibly common. You know, we're really wired to do anything we can to stay connected to our parents. You know, it's just such an innate need that we have, and we'll really twist ourselves into all kinds of pretzels in order to make it happen. And a lot of times the sense of, like, listen, I'll feel guilt or shame in order to keep this alive rather than accept that maybe it's not. You know, people are willing to take, you know, many people are willing to take a whole lifetime of guilt and shame for that.
Yeah, totally.
Do you have a sense of how you got past that?
You know, it is really difficult, but I think because after my song came out, he was trying again, and I was letting it happen, obviously. And then there was just this one point where I just felt the need to cut it off completely, just because I didn't think that it was good for my mental health whatsoever. And I think at that point, I realized that I'm worth more than that. And I have amazing people around me, and I have an awesome stepdad that kind of fills in that gap. And yeah, I think that's how I overcame it. Just realizing that the people around me love me tremendously, and I don't really need that anywhere else, you know?
Do you feel comfortable talking about the places where it might have been tougher, like where you were feeling that guilt, or, you know, maybe even, again, just this is a tough subject, so whatever you're comfortable with, you know, the arc of how it developed and how you went through the different feelings? Because I think, you know, one of the things that's very tough for people is that being on the other end of it, where you feel like you've come to some kind of resolution, is one thing, but when we're in it, we don't ever know for sure that we're going to come to that point.
Right.
And so it's sort of like, how were you thinking about it along the way? I think can be helpful for people in terms of trying to understand their own journey in that regard.
Of course. Well, I didn't come to terms with my feelings about him until I turned 18. I think that was like my breaking point where it kind of all just collapsed onto me. Not that I was missing out on him. It was more just I didn't have a father in my life, and I would see, you know, my friends and family have a perfect family, and it was really hard for me during those times, and I really felt like it was my fault, which now I obviously don't blame myself because I have nothing to do with the divorce, and I was 4. But you feel guilty, and you feel like it was your fault at the end of the day. And so when I rebuilt my relationship with him, I just felt like this is what needed to happen, not for me, but for him. I felt like I owed it to him. And then, you know, we got in this big argument because I told him that I will never call him, that he needs to call me, and that he needs to try because he's the father and I'm the kid, which should be self-explanatory, but I don't think he really understood that. And so we got in this big argument, and I think at that moment, I thought to myself, my mom would never talk to me like this, and my mom would never treat me like this, and my stepdad would never treat me like this. And so I think in that moment, I just realized that it was not worth it to fight with my dad.
Yeah, I think it's very tough. I think, again, especially as a kid, but even as an adult, I find it very difficult to know how you're quote-unquote supposed to behave in a relationship of any kind, really, because in an ideal world, we're all like so deeply committed to our relationships that there's a faith and a trust that everybody's trying to get there, wherever there is. So if you keep trying, it's like you'll eventually get there. And there's a lot of times where you're spending a lot of energy just trying to figure out, like, am I alone in this? Am I the only one who's giving to this? Am I giving too much? And it makes it very, very difficult, especially with a situation like this where someone's not there when you were younger, to figure out, like, how do I calibrate this? So this idea of calling someone versus wanting them to call you, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think a lot of people get very mixed messages about that in terms of how they should conduct their relationships, right? So in other words, I think some people will get the message or will give the message, listen, you know, you have to know, like you're saying, you have to know your worth. You know, don't call people who aren't calling you. And sometimes there's people out there who are saying, hey, listen, at the end of the day, if you want relationships to work, you've got to put in the effort. And both of those messages are out there in the world. And I do this for a living, and I'm an older person, and I still don't really know the answer to this. So I'm kind of curious just how you came to that conclusion, because I think a lot of people struggle with that idea of how much effort should I put in.
Yeah, I think for me, when I was younger, I did try to put in effort into our relationship by calling him, by trying to see him when I was home, and always being so kind and friendly and kind of acting like nothing happened. And, you know, I saw him for my birthday, like on my 16th birthday, which was 4 years, 5 years, I don't know. And after that, he didn't call me for like a year after that. No contact. And I think that's where it really hurt me, where I expected, you know, I expected him to call me after he saw me or text me and say it was good to see you, but he didn't, he really didn't text me for a year until my next birthday. And then he called me and acted like nothing happened. And I think that's where I set the boundary with him, where I told him, you know, I'm waiting around for your call, but I'm not going to call you because I just feel like, you know, if I call, then you're not putting in any effort. It's just like, oh, she's calling and I'm going to answer. But for me, it's like I was waiting around for his call and I didn't get any. And so I think that's where I told him, if you actually care about me and you want to keep in touch with me, then you have to call me and you have to text me because I'm done putting in effort. I think that was like my last straw, where it was like, you have to make this work, not me.
Yeah, you know, I just want to point out there's kind of a combo message that you gave, which I think was really powerful, this idea of I'm waiting for your call, but you have to call me. It's not, hey, I don't care, you call me. It's like, I'm waiting for your call. I feel like that's a very powerful way of delivering that message. Because I think it's sort of saying to somebody, hey, let's not play the game like I don't care, or like I'm being all coy about this. Like, I care. I am waiting. I need something from you here. Mm-hmm. It's so different than I think how, unfortunately, a lot of us find ourselves doing it. It's like we're kind of like either totally in and we're making all the effort, or we wind up being like, hey, you know, whatever it is. And I think the way you delivered that is really, really powerful. I'm sorry
it
didn't work as well as you had hoped.
It's okay. It's really okay.
Yeah. So if we could circle back to the hate that you're half of me, mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you're in this situation where you have this relationship and it's not working. You're setting that boundary. And maybe that's not the right term even. You're presenting that door. Because I think that's what that felt like to me. A boundary is like you have to, like, you cannot call me unless you stop drinking, right? That's like a boundary.
Yeah.
This is a, I'm showing you the door, mm-hmm. but you have to knock in order to get it. But then we're left with, again, that lyric, the hate that you're half of me, right? Which is this idea of, what do we do when we have relationships that have not worked particularly well, especially with parents, and we have to internalize, what does that mean? What does that mean about us? What does that mean about that person? What does it mean about future relationships? And how did you integrate all of that?
Oh, I think it was very difficult. There were two sides to every story with my parents being divorced. And I only really got to hear my mom's side of it, which was all true. It was really hard to handle because when I would see my dad, he would just constantly hate on my mom. And I think that was what really got me, because my mom is really so awesome for raising two girls, especially in the world that we're in now and that what we're doing. I think she did it so beautifully, and I look up to her so much. And I think the second my mom got brought up into conversation, it was really hard for me to continue to talk to him, because I just wanted him to be my dad, and I just didn't want him to comment on my mom, because he had a whole new family. We both were just separated for a very long time, and so I think navigating how to be okay with how that's going to happen. But I think that lyric in particular, that's kind of what I was feeling, where it was just like, I hate that you're half of me, because you're constantly bringing up how it was my mom's fault and how it was us. And it was like, I just feel like it didn't even feel like he was half of me. So I think that's another reason why I talked about it like that, because it was just like, you are not, you know nothing about me.
Yeah.
And that was ramble, but.
No, it's not. It's not. It's a very, there's a lot of different things that go into,
yeah.
Again, you know, some people use the term internalizing, like, mm-hmm. just like, what do you do with that? And especially, I think the complexity of what do you do when you already have mixed feelings and you feel like, for lack of a better saying it, the adults are not on the same page.
Yeah.
And there's definitely, I think, in parenting, you know, there's always a good balance of, like, you know, more discipline, less discipline, more future thinking, more in the moment. But the sort of, like, sort of tension over who's a good versus bad person.
Right.
When that happens, and it can happen, like, it can happen so quickly and without even realizing it. And you're like, oh my God, like, I'm trying to convince this person that this other person
right.
is bad. And then all of a sudden you're in a whole different discussion.
Totally. I think what was really helpful for me was my mom let me make my own decision no matter what. She never steered, because I've always been like, I love my dad. He's great. I want to see him. I want to be there with him. And she never told us that he was a horrible person, that we shouldn't try, that we shouldn't see him. And I think that is honestly what helped me in the long run, kind of create my own decision on how I felt. My sister and I's opinions on him were very different. So, and we kind of all just, it was okay.
Yeah, you know, I applaud your mom, because I'll tell you that is a very difficult thing to do yeah. as a parent, especially when you have your own personal history with someone.
Right.
And, you know, listen, one of the things that's very tough for any of us is that our narratives are constantly being rewritten, you know, especially as parents. Like, a lot of how we eventually decide on evaluating our life is like, well, what's our relationship with our kids? You know, are we, yep. you know, are we the villain or the hero in a given mm-hmm. story? And, you know, for your mom to be willing, especially knowing perhaps that there may have been some animosity being thrown her way, to give you that freedom is a lot. You know, it's that's just not an easy thing to do.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Let me shift a little bit, if it's okay. I want to talk about the 6 feet under concept. Tell me a little bit about that. I had my own interpretation of that song, but before I jump in, I'm kind of curious.
From of course,
actually
yeah.
the person who wrote it.
I wrote that song. I was not in a great relationship for 3 years of my life. And we went on a break for like a week and a half or something. And I ended up writing that song about our relationship because I just constantly felt like I was being held back in life, and that he was just dragging me down with him. It was sort of toxic, where I had to cut out a lot of people in my life and I wasn't allowed to do a lot of things. And so that's where the song came about.
It's interesting, because is the sickly sweet the same topic?
Sickly sweet is kind of the same topic, but it's more for the people that enjoy what's bad for them.
It's very interesting, because one of the things that when I was listening to 6 feet Under, it's interesting that what the song, I guess, was actually about, because the way I interpreted it was almost the opposite end of the spectrum of what you were describing with your relationship with your dad, right? Yeah. So there's something that feels very badly about a relationship that's just not there, you know, and you're just like, it's like floating in space. You're like pushing against air. There's just nothing. But then there's also something about a relationship that's very heavy, even in a positive way.
Right.
So when I heard the song, the way I heard it was, you are into me in the way that I want someone to be into me, but that the heaviness of that
yeah.
is overwhelming. Is that?
That's very accurate.
Yeah.
Yes.
We should probably talk about that a little bit. You know, we're sort of, I guess, thematically, we're sort of talking about just the way different, the whole spectrum of relationships can impact mm-hmm. our health and well-being. And this is the one that I think people have a particular amount of trouble with, mm-hmm. in terms of both how they are and how they receive things, because there is at least some research, some people use the term emotional over-involvement, where in theory, you know, depends on what you believe from the research, that when you have somebody who is so invested in you, mm-hmm. right? Like they're saying, like, you're my life. Like when you're down, I'm down. I can't, you know, I can't focus on my life if you're not doing well. That actually, the stress of that makes somebody's mental health who's on the receiving end worse.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, is that being loved in that way, in theory, is kind of something that a lot of us hope for. I mean, the idea that you're loved so much by somebody that you're their world, mm-hmm. on the one hand, it's almost like many of us, at least, you know, hope for that, or we're taught that that's what love should be. And then when you're in it, there may be parts of that that are good, but there are parts of that all of a sudden you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And especially if someone's struggling with their mental health to begin with, on a pure stress level, you're like, wow, this is just like an extra layer of burden.
Totally.
That I feel.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely felt that, like you were saying, it's not with ill intent. I think when I love someone very, very hard. And so does he. And I think it just got to the point where it was like, you are my life, you are my world, and he doesn't need anyone else. So it was more like I was his only friend, I was his only family, I was his only thing that he had to focus on. And so when I would be busy with friends and whatever, family, work, it was very difficult to, you know, have time away. That's where it got very isolating, where I just felt so responsible for his well-being, and I felt responsible for his emotions. I felt like if I made him happy, then if I tried to make him happy, he would be happy. If he was sad, it was because of me. If he was lonely, it was because of me. And I think that it can put a lot of stress on someone, because I am such a people pleaser and I want everyone in my life to be happy no matter what. So I definitely tried to do that for him. And I think, you know, you get lost in it, where you just forget about everyone else in your life that are the most important and have been there for you for everything, through everything. You know?
So let's go a little bit into this concept, because the concept of people pleasing is, you know, a lot of people will self-identify as that. And so what does that mean to you?
I think about people more than myself. If someone says they want to do something, I will do it for them. I pay for everything for everyone, because I just want everyone to be happy. I want to be the friend that really they can come to, and which is a good thing. I want to be the friend that anyone can come to if they need help or anything. I just seriously will drop anything for my friends and my relationships as well. And it sometimes gets in the way where I forget about my mental health and my well-being, and I'm not asking myself, like, hey, are you okay?
So most people, let's just say most people, when they identify, if you will, as a people pleaser, the thing that they will say to themselves is, I can do this. I don't think that people, if you really said, hey, listen, like, you know, you are going to be more depressed if you put in all this time to people. Be like, yeah, that'll happen for other people, but I can, you know, I can do it. So the thing is that, can you give me an example of where it turned or turns for you? Because in general, the thing that you're talking about is kind of like, well, man, who wouldn't want a friend or a significant other or a family member like that?
Right.
Right. And it's sort of like when people are, and you're going to probably get so much positive feedback for that. Right. Yeah. Where people are just like, oh my God, like you're probably like the person who's calling or like coming over, like, mm-hmm. you know, rather making that extra effort, showing up at things. And then it's sort of like, man, that's just a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, that's a lot of good things that we're starting to add on. Mm-hmm. But when does it become a problem? Like, if you can think of a time where you're like, okay, this was an example of a time where I chose someone over myself and it, you know, something popped.
Ooh, That's actually very difficult to think about.
You know, I was going through a really intense breakup sometime last year, and my friend was also going through a really insane breakup. I was going through a few mental things. I have really insane anxiety, and I try to ignore it for most of the time. But in this situation, I couldn't really eat anything. I was really throwing everything up. I could not keep it down. And my friend was also going through a breakup at the same time. I kind of just ignored how I was feeling and put all of my energy into hers. And I really was going through a hard time. And then I had to deal with the consequences later.
Was that more anxiety, like more poor eating? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's really tough. I think people pleasing is very, and listen, people pleasing is very common with people with eating issues, but I think it also resembles people with eating issues because it's only a problem at the very, 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 very last moment. Everything up until then, you're getting such praise for, you know, when people start losing weight, everybody's like, oh my God, you're losing weight. You're so healthy. So, and it's only at the point where they're severely underweight that people then start saying, ooh, you know, and all of a sudden all the kudos change into criticism. And people pleasing is very similar. It's like everybody, I is probably like, wow, like, you know, Kenzie is like the best friend. It's like, she's so amazing, like whatever. And then it's only at the very end that you're kind of like, okay, like now there's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's what sucks about it. It's that it's not incremental at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very tough to pick up in people. Did you, I don't know if get over it is the right term. How are you coping with it as a fellow people pleaser? I don't know that you ever really recover from these.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've learned recently that I have to put myself first for me to be in the best mental state I can possibly be in, because my anxiety sometimes creeps in at random parts of my life at like the most inconvenient times. And so I try to focus on that and try to deal with it.
Yeah, I found in the intervening time between your age and my age, I found that what happened was that I never had a sort of glorious epiphany. Like, I actually just felt like I ran out of steam, like where I couldn't do it anymore. It was almost like you want to play a sport so badly and you don't like give up playing the sport because you're like, you know what? I should really focus on studying or something. You're like, no, I actually just can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And that it's a hard way of learning a lesson, because you'd like to think that you come to that moment, you know? And so I'm glad you're coming to that moment, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess in a situation like that, so if we were to go back for the people who are going to be facing the situation, like what would you say in a situation like that? Like, how do you say to someone, hey, I'm having my own panic or anxiety, I'm having trouble eating, I just can't, when you're at your toughest moment? I mean, that is a rough, I think we need to workshop like how people can tell, you know, someone, hey, I'm in trouble here too.
You know, for me, I still don't know the answer to that. I think in that moment, I really was just there for her the whole time. And I just ignored how I was feeling until she kind of got over her situation. And then I was like, all right, it's time for me to figure this out. And I think that's when I started talking to my sister about it.
One of the things I'm wondering is going back to that model you had when dealing with your dad, the idea of saying like, look, I am here, I care, you know, you matter, I just need X, you know, like I need a night, you know, I need to get my own. But I think that what happens a lot of times, and part of the reason why people please, is that they don't feel like there's a kind way to say no.
Yeah.
But I think the way that you did it with your dad, I think might be one possible model of a solution. You know, just be like, listen, even if it's just like saying like, listen, I'm there, but just not tonight, or, you know, or I also need to tell you about what I'm going through.
Of course.
That first thing, I'm waiting by the phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's such a powerful way. Some version of that with friends, like, hey, I'm the same person that ran around to help you in all these different situations. That has not changed. I just need a breath.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm just going to pause for a second because we've come to sort of the part of the show where we started with one of your songs that represented your mental health journey. And we end with an artist or an album or a song or concert, whatever it was, something in someone else's music that has been important, I don't know, part of it, whether it's a place that you go to when you're not feeling at your best or you learn something from it.
I think right now, other music, I mean, Billie Eilish's new album, I mean, all the music she really makes, to me, I relate to all of it so much. And I feel every emotion when I listen to her music. And it's also just been a comforting, just everything she puts out, it's just very comforting to me because she was so young when she started and I was so young when I started, and I feel so close to her for some reason. I just feel like we've been through similar things. And so everything that she puts out, it feels very close to home for me. And I also just think she just says things so well. And I feel like the way she explains things in her music is just exactly how a lot of teenagers feel. I mean, I'm not a teenager anymore. I wish I was, but I just feel like she captures that really well in her music. And her album that recently came out, I've just been listening to it on repeat. I just feel very comforted when I listen to it.
I'm not a teenager either. I just wanted to be open about that. I can't hide anymore. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I think all the feelings, when you said that, I think Billie Eilish's music is definitely a good example of that, where you're feeling different things in the same song.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, you know, when you have that where you're like, okay, this is pushing a lot of buttons at once, there's something very powerful about that. And I guess you know, to some degree, you could sort of argue, is that a model for our, you know, our most satisfying relationships, where it's like, listen, like, obviously, like, if you have one person who does one thing, one person does another thing, those are valuable as well. But the people in our lives who really, you know, sort of connect with us on all those levels is where you really go to during those tough times.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So, Kedzie, thank you so much for coming on Going There. It's been great talking with you. I'm sorry, you know, to be honest, that we're talking about, in some cases, these very difficult topics.
It was honestly great to talk to you about it, because I feel like you also helped me through it a bit. So thank you.
No, well, I'm glad. But it's definitely,
you're awesome.
I feel very confident it's going to help people, you know, who are going through this stuff. And so, you know, listen, it's been great to, you know, start following your career, and I wish you the best of luck, and I hope we get a chance to talk again.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been awesome.
So there it is. Kedzie and I talking about the importance of managing relationships, especially difficult ones, on our mental health journey. Now, there's so much to take away from the conversation with Kedzie, but one of the issues that I wanted to highlight was something that we talked about towards the end of our discussion, which is the concept of people-pleasing. Now, in theory, people-pleasing refers to a pattern of behavior in relationships in which we are more concerned with the needs of others than with our own needs, and that we want people to think highly of us, or at least not to be mad at us, even if it means we do things that might otherwise not be optimal for us. This can manifest in something as seemingly minor as agreeing to whatever plan someone else wants, regardless of our preferences, or not speaking up if someone is hurting our feelings in some way. And we do it because people-pleasing may, in fact, be an effective way to get people to like us and want to connect with us. And while we hope that this behavior will ingratiate us with others, and it might in fact work, It often leaves us feeling less satisfied and even marginalized in our most important relationships. The people in our lives get used to not considering our needs and feelings when they make their choices in the relationship. In the worst case scenarios, people pleasing can be something potentially more harmful, like not confronting a loved one on toxic behavior, such as addiction or abuse, for fear that that person will be displeased with us. So how do we manage our urge to people please? I think we can learn a great deal from Kenzie's discussion from setting boundaries while still keeping an open heart. First, one of the most important things we can do is validate that it is understandable that we want good relationships, that it feels good for people not to be displeased with us. Second, it is helpful for us to think of what kind of a friend, family member, employee, or significant other that we want to be, and give it all we have to develop and nurture those relationships, as Kenzie described, showing up to events, keeping in contact, helping people when needed, all important things. And the more we behave in a way that is consistent with how we want to be in relationships, the more we can reassure ourselves that we are doing everything we can to make those relationships work. But the key difference that Kenzie described between building a healthy relationship and one based on people-pleasing is that we have to treat ourselves as we would treat others. And that sometimes means prioritizing ourselves just like we prioritize others. And that boundaries where we take ourselves into consideration are not harmful to other people. It's actually what allows us to take care of ourselves so that we can feel good and continue to feel warm and loving towards others. And it is okay for us, as Kenzie did, to seek out and prioritize people who respect our boundaries and want us to feel like we matter to them as much as they do to us. And this is particularly important if we struggle with mental health issues such as depression and anxiety, when we need to prioritize ourselves over others to take care of ourselves at times. And if we can do this, and we can have healthy relationships instead of just people-pleasing, we will learn how to take care of ourselves as well as we take care of others on our mental health journey. I want to thank Kenzie for this wonderful conversation. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. And I, of course, want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and Sound Mind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or addiction and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. If you're thinking about harming yourself and want to seek help, please contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. You may also go to the Sound Mind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullis, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.